Hello, welcome or welcome back to the Just Eat Normally podcast for eating disorder recovery with me, Dr. Rachel Evans. I am a psychologist, hypnotherapist with a PhD in the psychology of eating and specialist training in eating disorder recovery, as well as personal experience of going through an eating disorder and coming out the other side, which makes me super passionate about what I do. And in every episode, as with my one-to-one clients, I'm bringing you academic knowledge, information, and theories, as well as therapeutic skills and personal experiences, be that mine or experiences of my guests, for a unique perspective on eating disorder recovery. So join me on this podcast as I speak to fellow experts in eating disorder recovery, eating disorder survivors with inspiring stories, and also throw in some bite-sized solo episodes with recovery tips or new ways for you to think about things. The goal of this podcast is to give you food for thought, to shift your mindset, to boost your motivation, and to help you find your own version of normal eating, which will allow you to live a truly nourished life. Hi everyone, welcome back. So today I am with Ash Saruya, a psychotherapist, artist, and storyteller living and working in Westchester, New York metropolitan area, and they are passionate about fat positivity, health at every size, trauma-informed eating disorder treatment, weight stigma, social justice, quite a few were still going, ADHD treatment, which is, well, ADHD is what we're going to be talking about today, and harm reduction, and the messy and complex reality that is being human in this world. So I love that. It feels very aligned to this podcast. And Ash also shares more of their creative projects on Instagram, which you can find them at Bad Ash Therapy. And I'll put those links in the show notes and I'll ask her again at the end where to find her. So I'm also just conscious, actually, that I saw your pronouns being they or she. Is that, that's okay? Okay,
perfect. Yes, I like to use both. So yeah, if you can throw in both at different various times, that would be great.
Yeah. Okay, so is there anything else that you'd like to tell people about yourself before we get going?
I mean, I think all of that is, you know, relevant to me. I wrote it 2 weeks ago, so it should be. I think the only other thing that maybe your listeners should know is that I do have personal experience with all of the things that I specialize in, and I'm sure we'll get into that throughout the show, especially based on your, you know, first main question. But yeah, I have my own experience with this, and that's what brought me to the work.
So I have copied and pasted the questions, but I'm like, did I say that the first question was going to be about your experience, or did I say it was going to be what is ADHD?
So, okay. So you'd have the suggested questions about specifically ADHD and eating disorders, but in the format section you have, we'll start by speaking about your relationship with food and your body.
Okay, perfect. Up. I did think that that's what it was, but I've not written that down. So let's go.
I'm looking at it right now to help guide me through because I have ADHD and I need something to focus on. So totally hear you. Forgot.
Yeah, perfect. So, okay. I guess what was your experience like with food and your body when you were growing up?
Yeah. So it's so funny looking back, and I hear this from a lot of people that I work with too, and people that I engage with on social media about this stuff, that we grew up being told by other people that we were fat or that our bodies were unacceptable. And then when we look back at pictures, like, it's very clear that we were really of average size. Not that being a fat kid is bad. And in some ways I probably was, especially in like late middle school. But you know, when the body shaming and sort of like input from other people outside of me came in from an early age, it was all about like size and being small. I'm 27, so I grew up in like late 90s, early 2000s. So it was very like Paris Hilton style of beauty aesthetic. And I definitely wasn't that, you know, I wasn't lanky. I wasn't, you know, tall. I mean, I was tall for my family because my family's pretty short, but in any case, I had a lot of external messaging growing up that there was something wrong with my body. And then I also had this sort of like binge restrict tendency with food, which in hindsight, I realize was ADHD. Like that's, you know, how I was trying to manage that. But in the moment, it was really associated with my body size. And so it was like, anytime I would binge, it was associated with weight gain. And then I also developed, I actually don't think I had anything more serious than like an insulin resistance thing, but I had so much anxiety that I felt sick all the time. Like I was nauseous all the time. And so I was just constantly going to doctors, and, you know, every doctor that I went to told me that I was just fat, which, you know, it's a complicated thing to hear from a doctor when you're 12. So between the doctor stuff and like peer stuff and media and family, I started developing a pretty severe restrictive tendency like late high school into college. And then when I got to college, as with many people who go off to university like without dealing with their shit, everything just exploded. Like it just got so out of hand, and like I couldn't contain it all. And so I went to my mom and I was like, it was my spring break freshman year. I was like, I need a therapist. Like, I can't do this anymore. I genuinely am so exhausted. I cannot do it. And so I started therapy, and I didn't, you know, work with anyone who was specifically focused in eating disorders, but her approach really helped me. And it was very like, very self-compassion driven. So it was really about like self-acceptance and radical self-acceptance. And that's definitely, I think, a big part of the work. So it wasn't focused on eating disorders, but it ended up helping in that area as well. And it was through that work that I realized how much complex trauma I had and how much that contributed to my relationship with my body, and like the hypervigilance that I felt all the time, the discomfort in my own body that I felt. And then fast forward a couple of years, I started seeing a lot of ADHD content on like social media, I think. And I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been dealing with. So I sort of, you know, diagnosed myself a little bit. I confirmed my psychiatrist, but diagnosed myself first. And that really put all the other pieces into place in terms of me looking back in hindsight at my relationship with food and my relationship with my body, and seeing how, you know, these various factors, including like rejection sensitivity and the binge restrict cycle, and also just body image distress more broadly, it can be much more intense for people with ADHD. So, and just emotional regulation more broadly too, like feeling like your emotions are really out of hand. And in many ways I used food to cope with that. Which is also a very common ADHD thing, because food gives you dopamine, you know? So it's like, it's this continual sort of like unraveling of like, oh shit, this all made sense. Like I wasn't, you know, I wasn't actually losing my mind. I wasn't actually, you know, being a piece of shit. Cause I'm sorry, I curse. Am I allowed to curse?
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay. I just have to make a note, or if I don't remember, I'll just mark any podcast as explicit just in case, but we'll, that's fine. It's not the worst swear word.
Got it. I curse a lot. So, but yeah, so it just, it really helped me put all the pieces in place when I realized like, oh no, I don't have a binging problem. I do experience binges, but it's really a restriction problem, and it's a cycle, and this is what it looks like, and this is why I'm engaged in it. And then I also found, you know, fat positivity and intuitive eating and health at every size in that kind of first therapy experience. And that really helped a lot too, just in terms of embracing my body, embracing, you know, my body type. And then I recovered into a fat body, and, you know, that there was a lot of stuff wrapped up in that too. And that took some work. But I think at this point, I was actually talking to a patient the other day, and they asked me like, do you really think, like, as someone in a larger body, as someone who experiences marginalizations, like, do you really think that recovery is possible? And I said to them, I was like, honestly, I really do. Because it's not to say that I don't have moments where I'm like, eh, about my body. But when those moments happen, I know that it's about so much more than what my body looks like in that moment. Usually it's attached to like feeling insecure, or, you know, feeling like my self-confidence has taken a blow. And the more frequent thought, the more common thought that I have is, wow, I can't believe I ever thought I wasn't supposed to be in this body. And that shift has been really, really positive.
Thank you for covering so much. I'm not even going to try and summarize it, actually, because you touched on so many important points. I was just nodding along. I think we'll just actually jump into like what is ADHD, because it sounds like when you were having maybe some signs and symptoms of it, you didn't actually realize maybe this is something that could get a diagnosis. And I'm also interested in your thoughts on the diagnosis a bit later. But like just broadly, what is ADHD? What does that acronym stand for? What might people be struggling with?
Sure. Well, I hope I get the acronym right. It's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, I think. I'm almost positive. I'm not great with acronyms, but that's the general gist. And the signs and symptoms, it should be noted, look different for different kinds of people, people who've experienced different things. So for example, there's often a difference in how it is expressed in cis men and versus cis women. And ADHD is something we often see as children, so cis boys and cis girls.
Yeah. Can I just jump in? I was thinking probably the stereotype, isn't it? Is there's like a little boy who like doesn't concentrate in class and is like bouncing around the classroom is what
screaming
you tend
and yelling
to think
around the
about.
Classroom. Yep. Absolutely. And that's always the example that I give to folks when I'm explaining to them, like, this is the media representation of ADHD. This is sort of the general public's understanding of ADHD, which is that like young boy running around the classroom screaming and the teacher like losing their mind. Like that is what we think of when we think of ADHD. And that does exist. And for cisgender girls, for people who were socialized as cisgender girls, we are taught to internalize, to shove down, to be prim, right? To be like very constrained. That is what being a you know, good girl, in quotes, means in a lot of ways. And so because of that, when we have those hyperactive desires, we don't run around the classroom screaming, although some of us do, but a lot of us internalize it. And so all of that hyperactivity ends up in our brains up here. And so it's this constant loop of like self-doubt, self-criticism. And it's one of the reasons why perfectionism is such a tell for me when I meet with people who, you know, grew up as, you know, socialized as women, that when the perfectionism is really, really loud, it tends to indicate to me they've been doing this perfectionism thing their whole life to manage something. And it's not always ADHD, but a lot of times it is. And so, you know, the symptoms I look for, because again, they're a little bit different than the symptoms you might typically look for, are perfectionism, having sort of a binge restrict relationship with food where you feel like sometimes all you want to do is eat and other times food sounds so unappetizing. Different kinds of subtler stimming and attempts at seeking sensory input. So that can, you know, look many different ways. Playing instruments can be a form of stimming. Fidgeting is a form of stimming. So noticing when people are like doing things with their hands and like always looking for something to mess around with, especially when they're having a conversation, it helps us focus.
It's so funny. I'm just sat here like playing with my sock. Do stuff. And I'm just saying, when we're going through this, it's obviously not for people to self-diagnose. If you're having some like, oh, ding, ding, that's me, maybe it's something you want to look into. But we're not saying, like you said, every instance of perfectionism is linked
absolutely
to ADHD. But yeah, I'm going to carry on play with my sock while you tell us.
Yeah. Love that. And that's to me what a lot of the treatment is helping people understand what their own ADHD brain looks like, right? Because even within these like broader maybe examples or symptoms that we might talk about, not everyone experiences all of the symptoms and some of them might look different for other people. So, you know, it's about helping people learn what their brains really need and what it looks like to be inside them. And then trying to accommodate whatever your needs are. So for example, if you're struggling to focus on a conversation and you notice that when you're messing with something in your hands, you can focus, even if you're not looking at the person, well, then that means it's helpful for you. And that's something that we should incorporate rather than feel shame about or, you know, pile on that like, well, why can't I just focus like regular people? It's like, well, because your brain's not regular. Like, let's figure out how to make it work for you, because otherwise you're just going to be bumping up against the wall your entire life. And that leads to a lot of suffering. And again, for people who internalize these messages, it can lead us to believe that we are damaged, that we, you know, just can't function like, quote, regular people.
Yeah, that was going to be something that I want to touch on. I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, but it's almost like society is set up in one way.
Yes.
For, we would say, neurotypical, and everyone else is expected to fit into that. Do you think that, I guess, some of the issues that people might experience with ADHD are because of trying to fit in, or some are genuinely like you're saying, maybe if you feel like, I just want to eat all the food, maybe that would be feel like an issue to you in that situation, regardless of what society was saying. Do you think it's a bit of both, or it's trying to fit?
I think it's definitely a bit of both. Like that example you just gave, I think part of the reason we have so much shame around that particular behavior is because of fat phobia. You know, like if we didn't connect eating, you know, what we think is too much, quote unquote, with being in a larger body, eating, quote, too much wouldn't really matter.
I mean, it depends, you know? If you're like, oh God, I feel really sick now and this is uncomfortable.
Sure,
and
but
this
that
is a problem for me
good.
Specifically.
For
Yeah.
Exactly. It's that, right? We don't necessarily feel shame if like we feel sick. Right? Like, it's like, oh, I ate a little too much from my stomach, couldn't handle it, and I feel sick. Like, that's a neutral descriptor of what's happening versus, oh my God, I ate so much. What the fuck is wrong? I'm sorry. What is wrong with me? And, you know, I'm disgusting, right? All those judgments and like the stuff that comes from that, like external fat phobia and healthism in a lot of ways, you know? So I do think that there's, you know, a lot of ways in which our culture pushes us in the direction of judging and shaming the things that we struggle with and the ways that we naturally function in a lot of ways, because it doesn't make us very good workers. And we live in capitalism, and the whole point is to use our bodies for work and profit. And we can't really do that if we are being our authentic selves, because most of our authentic selves don't want to sit and work for, you know, 70 hours a week.
Fair enough. I'm like, I don't know if anyone does if we drill down to it. So I guess, how is ADHD like typically treated or managed?
So typically, I think the go-to for people is medication. And that's not to say that I don't think medication can't be a part of ADHD management. I definitely think it can. But I think sometimes what happens is, A, the medication can have some pretty intense side effects, especially for people who have a comorbid eating disorder, because of the fact that they're a stimulant and they can deaden your appetite. And so if you're trying to recover while you're also getting initially treated for ADHD, that can be really complicated. To be clear, not everyone has that side effect. It's a potential side effect, but it is a common one. And I just lost my train of thought. How is it treated? So a lot of people use medication mostly as like the frontline treatment, and that's fine to some extent. Because I work at the intersection of eating disorders, I actually try to go a different route, at least initially. Like I said, I think medication can be a part of the sort of overall treatment approach, but I do think that learning how your brain likes to function and making space for it are the two most important pieces of this, because there's so much shame and judgment around, you know, struggling to put food together for a meal, struggling to get out of bed in the morning, struggling with transitions, which is something that ADHDers often struggle with. Like a lot of things that we often associate with, quote, being an adult, like being a functioning adult, whatever that means, are things that ADHDers tend to struggle with. And so there's usually a lot of shame, internalized shame, around not being able to function. Even though we can, it just looks different than other people.
Yeah. I was thinking, oh, I've still got baby brain. I guess when you were talking, I was thinking, it sounds like if you understand what's going on for yourself better, and like you say, like your unique situation, that you're actually going to be more adaptable.
Yes.
And apply that to different situations rather than if you had medication with no additional support,
Right.
it doesn't
Exactly.
sound as helpful on the surface.
Right. Absolutely, especially when medications have side effects. And sometimes we have to stop medications for various reasons. And if your only tool is medication, and then I don't know, say you have to stop it for like a surgery or something else happens with your health, you can't take it anymore. Well, then now you're sort of starting at zero again. I mean, not fully, because at least you know what's going on, but now you have to learn how to navigate all of this stuff instead of sort of letting the meds do it for you. And I say that, but the meds also don't do it for you. Even when you are on the medication, like, yes, the meds are helpful and they can be transformative for people. And it still requires some level of skills, but I think it's a different skill set than if you don't have the medication at all.
And I guess, what impact do you think that kind of treatment, whether that's medication or, like you were saying, finding these different tools, has for someone that has risk factors to developing an eating disorder? If they're struggling with an eating disorder, do you think treatment would look slightly different? I know we've kind of touched on this a bit.
Right. Yeah. So that's, like I said, the way that I approach treatment is slightly different because of that intersection. Because, you know, when you're trying to recover from an eating disorder, or when you're struggling with an eating disorder, it's very tempting to take a medication that you know is going to possibly suppress your appetite. It can become a motivator in and of itself. And so it almost, in for some people, may not even matter if the medication helps with their executive functioning, for example. If it's helping them not eat, well, then it's great. And if that's what's happening, that means that the ADHD treatment is actively threatening the recovery treatment, if that's something that they're in treatment for. So it, in my opinion, it has to be different. And that doesn't mean that medication isn't a part of it. It can be, but it's more that the therapist's job is to provide adequate psychoeducation on it. Like, these are the things that can happen. And if you are experiencing this symptom, like a deadened appetite, we need to talk about it. And that doesn't necessarily mean we need to pull you off the meds immediately. If you're able to, say, eat on a schedule, then it potentially can be fine. But if that's something that's really difficult for you, and then you don't have your intuitive senses connected to your food and stuff like that because of the meds, well, then we have a problem, because you got to eat, you got to get nourishment in. You know, your ADHD is going to be even more difficult to manage if you're undernourished. So it's definitely, medication is a trickier piece, I think, when you have the eating disorder comorbidity.
I guess you also mentioned as well about stimulation and food and things. Like, I wonder, it's not on the question list, but like, how do you think about binge eating now and recovery? And almost, I guess I'm kind of reading that you maybe have like a reframing approach to it rather than this is a problem, this is off limits. And obviously, like we discussed that, if it feels like a problem to the person,
Right.
that's a
And
bit
it
different. But
absolutely is.
like
It's distressing internally, right? Like, and it can hurt, like, physically. It's not comfortable when you eat in a way that doesn't feel good for your body, right? That's just on its face true. And more often than not, binging is the result of either physical restriction or mental restriction, or a combo of both. And that's the most common, right? And so, to me, in my point of view, the binge is like your body's safety valve. The binge is your body being like, I don't want to die, thank you. So let's push you with everything we can, like, you know, releasing hunger hormones and slowing down your metabolism, like doing everything we can biologically to drive you towards food. So we look at that as something that we should feel ashamed about. But in truth, it is a reflection of our body's kind of magical ability to stay alive. You know, like, even in the face of cultural shame, it's still doing it. It's like, I don't care about your cultural shame. I don't want to die. So it's a very different way of looking at it. And I think it opens up our ability to look at the binge almost like a tool, like a coping tool that can be in your toolkit, right? Now, to be clear, you want your toolkit to be broad. You want your toolkit to be varied, because a binge isn't always going to be the thing that actually works, right? If you, for example, I don't know, just went out to a big dinner and you're really full and, like, just physically full, And, but there's this part of you that like wants stimulation, for example, like we were talking about from the ADHD perspective. You absolutely can go and, I don't know, have some dessert or whatever. Maybe that's what you're looking for, but it may not feel good physically, right? Now you could decide that you're cool with that. You're fine with that. You don't have anything tomorrow and you could sleep in and sleep it off and whatever. But maybe you have a big meeting the next morning and you're like, you know what? I don't think this is actually going to be a great idea in the long run. So maybe I can seek stimulation in a different way right now for this particular moment, right? Not that it's a rule, not that you can't use food for stimulation, but that maybe it's not always the choice that is actually the most supportive.
Yeah. I mean, I think that sounds pretty similar to what I do with clients as well, trying to help them understand maybe in the situation, what is the function of the binge eating, or like, what is its job to try and help me feel differently or do in this situation. So like you say, maybe sometimes it is about stimulation, or maybe sometimes my clients, they're trying to zone out from it. And then we're thinking, is this actually working for you though? And maybe sometimes it's like, yes, do you know what? So much has gone on this week. I'm near the beginning of recovery. This is just the only thing that feels like it's going to help. And I definitely had instances of that myself, that I was just like, I cannot cope. I have bulimia without binging and then making myself sick. But then I started to realize, actually, do you know what? This isn't working for me.
Right.
What else could I do in this situation? Exactly. And it's like, I could still do that, but it's not appealing to me to
and
do that anymore.
Right. When someone says to you, well, you're allowed, like, it's cool. Like, do it. If that really feels like the thing, like, okay, well, then it's way less alluring. Because if someone tells you not to do it, well, then that's the thing you want to do. Like, that's just human nature. You know?
Yeah. And then also just touching on what you mentioned at the start of your answer to that about the physiological side of things, that seems to just be generally across human beings. You restrict, like you say, your body's going to want to eat to help, which when it's happening is very distressing. But, you know, if you can start to understand maybe why it's happening, and then often people are like, oh, okay, maybe I will eat a bit more to try and prevent this happening because I really want to avoid that binge.
Right. Which is fine, because like we said, there are physical repercussions of a binge that and emotional ones that don't always feel good. And so, yeah, it can be a motivator to nourish more consistently throughout the day, because that is one of the best ways to stay off a binge.
Okay. And so I guess this is my question, but I know it sort of led into it, sort of haven't. I guess what would a weight inclusive approach to eating disorder recovery with ADHD look like?
Yeah, so I think everything that we've been sort of talking about is already what a weight inclusive approach looks like. And I think that, not to say that everyone who binges ends up in a larger body, because that's not necessarily the case. But for those in larger bodies who do binge, binging is usually connected to their larger body, either, you know, culturally or in their own mind or both. And so there's a lot of work, I think, that has to go into normalizing the binge, accepting the binge, looking at the binge as the safety valve, as, you know, a tool that your body is using to keep you here. I think that's a huge piece of it, because when you have shame about a behavior, generally speaking, and you can tell me if you've experienced this too or seen it with your clients, but when there's shame behind a behavior, it becomes in many ways the driving force. That shame, you know, creates this cycle of feeling like you can't stop.
Yeah, definitely. I'm thinking about, I don't remember every podcast I've ever done, but I do know in the episode with Sarah DeSandro, when we were talking about binge eating, we said this, I thought it was good when I re-listened to it, a really good bit about shame. And she was saying similar, sometimes you're eating because of that shame.
Right.
And if you just, I know it's, I say if you just, but if you work to let go of that shame, actually sometimes the behavior isn't as appealing.
Yes.
Then if you're like, oh, actually, you know, I could go into the kitchen and eat, just for example's sake, that whole tub of ice cream. Oh, okay, great.
Right. Like, right. I could do that. Okay. Right. Versus like, what? No, you can't do that. What do you mean? What do you like? And I'm sure many of us listening have been there.
I've got to do it before someone sees me.
Yes. Right. Yes. The urgency, the adrenaline rush, the secrecy, the hiding, like it gets so intense, you know? Whereas when it's sort of like, well, I could, that's it. That's the end of, like, that's it. You could. It just neutralizes it.
Yeah. And I guess a non weight inclusive approach would be when, you know, therapists are maybe saying like, oh, if you stop binge eating, you'll lose the weight, or I won't let you get over a certain weight, or it's not like, let's leave that weight as a side issue for a while.
Exactly. To me, weight is the thing that we need to let go of, you know, because at the end of the day, we have research that shows us that staying at your current weight is much more supportive to your health, whatever that weight is, than going up and down on the weight spectrum, which is much, much more likely to happen than any kind of sustained weight loss for more than 5 to 7 years. So just scientifically, it's not really a sustainable option in many ways to say to somebody, okay, I understand you're in a larger body now and that's not comfortable for you. And we think it's about your binging, which again is, you know, not a fair assessment necessarily. But you know, we're going to work on that. And that means you're going to stop binging and you're going to lose weight and you're going to be the person you always wanted to be, which is basically enabling the eating disorder.
Everyone has the right to say what they want on the internet, but when I see people advertising their stuff like that, I'm like, like I feel like I was nearly at that point once. I wasn't quite that explicit, but I guess I was still concerned. I don't think I had an eating disorder at that point. I think I'd recovered, but I was still concerned with like being the healthiest that you can, like let your body drop weight.
And then, that's like, common.
Actually understanding the research that you know, diets don't work. Understanding health at every size, I've definitely changed my perspective on that a lot.
Yeah, and that evolution I think is really normal for people, especially for people who aren't themselves already in larger bodies and so don't have to kind of confront that immediately, right? But I think it's very common for people to kind of emerge out of like a very restrictive or I know you mentioned bulimia, like that kind of behavior into sort of like a more orthorexic style, right? Like a healthist, you know, we just want to be the healthiest we can be. And look, for some people, that is an important goal for them and that's fine. But health is not something that we are required to perform for other people. You know, it's a personal thing and it's something that we get to decide for ourselves what it looks like, what it feels like, what it means. Because what's healthy for one person isn't necessarily healthy for another.
Yeah, I'm just thinking when I was trying to be healthy and then I was just making myself do stuff that I didn't want to do. And I mean, sometimes I enjoyed it. I think I made myself enjoy kale smoothies, which I don't enjoy now. Which if you like them, great.
Well, right. I mean, like, it's not, it's so funny because I definitely.
On one hand, no one cares.
Right. But there's definitely a point in recovery where people, and myself included, will be like, am I allowed to have a salad? Like, does that mean I'm dieting? Like, what if I really like salad? Like, what if I really like gluten-free bread or whatever? I don't think gluten-free bread's one people tend to like, but and regardless, like, you're allowed to like what you like. And like, there are going to be foods that maybe in your mind are associated with dieting or restricting that you actually genuinely enjoy and like want to incorporate into your life, right? It's about the reason behind why you're eating it. Are you eating it because you think it's the good restrictive option? Or are you eating it because it's what you want?
Yeah. And I suppose just to acknowledge as well, like we're saying about recovery, sometimes like you said, orthorexia comes after a certain amount of recovery. Like you've still probably made a lot of progress to get to that point, but it might also be that that's not really working for you if you were honest about it.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there are many, you know, for most of us, there are many steps, you know, out of recovery, out of an eating disorder, right? Into recovery. There are phases and, you know, that's okay because you can't see what you can't see until you've, you know, passed certain hurdles. So it takes time and it's a process and it's a process of peeling away the layers, you know, like you can't see what's inside at the core of the onion, so to speak, if we do a Shrek reference here. if all the other layers are covering it, you have to peel it away and then you can see what's there and then you can deal with it. You know, it doesn't mean that you, haven't done any work or the work or, you know, that you have missed something. It just means that you're finally at the point that you can face that.
Yeah. So I guess, if someone is listening to this because they already know that they have, ADHD or they're neurodiverse and they were looking for a therapist, I guess Do you think the process would be slightly different than someone else looking for a therapist, or certain questions that someone might want to ask?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's important that if you yourself suspect you might have ADHD or ASD, which are the two kind of most typically thought of when we think about neurodiversity, although technically all mental illnesses make us neurodiverse, just as an aside. But if you think those might be in your experience, I do think it's important to work with somebody, especially if you have issues with food, which it's likely you do if you have ADHD, it's very common. It's very important, I think, to work with somebody who is familiar with how those things interplay with one another, because it does look different. The understanding behind the behaviors is different. The perspective is different because it isn't about like even necessarily like looking at behaviors, quote unquote, and engaging with behavioral adjustments, which can be a part of it. But it's really more about understanding the utility of this thing that many of us look at as a negative. And in many cases, what I'm referring to is like using food as an emotional coping tool. So I think one of the biggest things that I do that is different from a lot of, maybe not necessarily you, but a lot of people in the eating disorder space is that emotional eating to me is as valid a tool of coping as any other. You know, it's important. It's literally like the first coping mechanism that we have when we are born, right? When a baby cries, they are tired, they need to be changed, or they want food. And then they stop crying. Like it's a built-in coping mechanism. And we have so thoroughly demonized it in our culture broadly that we no longer feel as a broader culture that we are able to use food in an emotional way, right? It's like food must be for fuel, quote unquote, right? It's not meant to be pleasurable. It's not meant to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Indulgent. You know, when in actuality, food is one of the greatest joys of life, and like we're supposed to enjoy it. It's magical, you know.
Okay, yeah, I think that is important. I actually haven't done training specifically about neurodiversity. I was going to do some, but then I had a baby, and now I'm like, no, I just don't have that. I have had clients with various different issues, but I suppose we've just kind of applied the principles that you were talking about, perhaps mm-hmm. certain things that I didn't know, which would have been helpful for me to know, but we've managed to like work out, okay, where's your, I can't think how to phrase this, like, so for example, when you said ASD, like autism spectrum, like working mm-hmm. out, okay, what is coming from that? And mm-hmm. what is coming from your fear of doing that? Yeah. Or like, it's so interesting, just go off topic for a minute. I had a client who kept saying, I'm not flexible. I can't be flexible, which is almost a stereotype. Yeah. Autism, and I did mm-hmm. challenge her on. I obviously wasn't going to push it so yeah. far, but just to say, is that what you? If you keep telling yourself that, mm-hmm. that's going to mm-hmm. happen, and maybe to a certain extent that is true. Mm-hmm. But there's some activities that I do with people, like anyone actually, regardless, mm-hmm. if they want to do it to help with flexibility or seeing that you can mm-hmm. actually do things differently. So I think obviously, if you can't find a therapist who is a specialist in that area, there are other people who might be appropriate
absolutely
to work with as well.
Yes, definitely. And like, I don't know that there's really like, there's not a training that I took, for example, to mm-hmm. like make me competent in this area. I have personal experience with it, so that really drives a lot of what I just kind of know. And then as well as just, you know, taking in information, because in the last 5 years, so much information has come out about ADHD that we didn't know before. Mm-hmm. So it's really, there's been a boom in information that's available around these conditions. And I just have sort of, you know, soaked it all up, but it's not like I have some kind of, you know, even continuing education necessarily in this area, because it's a very new area. So I think it really is about just finding people who are aware and familiar with the fact that it does affect the larger picture, you know, and how it affects the larger picture. In many ways, when I sit with a patient, I don't necessarily know. I have my assumptions, right, because of my own experiences and people I've worked with, but how it is experienced for them could be completely different. And it's really about joining the client in figuring out what does this look like for you. And to me, as long as your therapist is able to like meet you where you're at and hear you, and, you know, like, I think the example you just gave is really great, right? Like accepting that, okay, yeah, there might be a degree of flexibility that isn't actually doable here, but there also might be some that is. So can we try this a little bit? And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But let's just see, like, let's just play around with it and see. And I think having that openness and ability kind of to look at your client as an individual person, right? Which really shouldn't be what's the word? Shouldn't be rare in the therapy field. But unfortunately, it can be hard to come by. But I think, you know, if you're meeting with a therapist, for example, for the first time, and you think you might have ADHD, it's worth asking, you know, what familiarity do you have with ADHD? Do you understand how it interacts with eating disorders? If you don't, are you willing to learn about it? And if you're not willing to learn about it, do you know anyone in your network who does?
Yeah. And just on that point, I think I've said this before, sometimes like people don't. I hate it when someone asks me, oh, can you know anyone to refer to about this? And I'm like, no, because I always feel pressure, like, oh, I should know the perfect person to send them to. And I know it's really annoying if you're the one asking and the person's like, no, but sometimes it's not always possible.
Well, right. I mean, there are not many of us that do this work in particular, right? Or who advertise that they do this work. So it can be hard to know who to point people to for sure.
Yeah. So also I saw in your Instagram profile that you kind of have a little bullet point that says trauma, ADHD, OCD, which she's not touched on and we're not going to. But it also says cannabis. And I was wondering if that's like something that you use personally or in what forms, or if that's something that you also talk about with clients.
Yeah. So both. I do use it personally and I do talk about it with patients. You know, I think as someone who has ADHD and OCD, my brain is very loud all the time. And I find that when I use cannabis, my brain slows down a little bit. It's a little easier to exist within it. I also have chronic pain. And so I use cannabis to manage that as well. And, you know, a lot of my patients have found some semblance of relief with cannabis. And to be clear, cannabis is a drug. And, you know, if you're under 21, you should not be using it. And of course, it is not federally legal in the United States. It's not legal in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you should always be using any kind of substance with, you know, people you trust and all of that. And I think cannabis is pretty freaking magical when it comes to mental health support and chronic pain support. I think it can even, you know, there's a lot of research now about magic mushrooms and, you know, psilocybin stuff, and how doing, whether it's like microdosing or various other protocols, can help broaden your brain to kind of see the world in a bigger picture kind of way. And I think that is something that I talk to patients about all the time, right? Like, what's the 10,000 foot view? If we take a step back, like, what's the bigger picture here, especially for people with ADHD, when, you know, those of us with ADHD tend to struggle with like looking out towards the future. It's more like what's in front of my face. That's what I can, you know, focus on. Right. But I think, you know, when you use, drugs that have a mind enhancing quality to them, it can really change your perspective a little bit on the world, and on your place in it, in a way that can help you, at least in my experience, let go of some of the shame and judgment and narratives that have in many ways probably plagued you your whole life.
Do you think that also has an impact on people's appetite as well, though? Because
Absolutely.
Just make everything more complicated.
Well, and it's funny too, because like on the one hand, it's like, yeah, it could. It doesn't always for everybody, right? And depends on the strain for sure. But cannabis can absolutely stimulate the appetite. And as an eating disorder therapist, I love that. I'm like, yeah, go eat. Because as I'm sure you know, when you've been restricting for a long time, your hunger cues can completely disappear. So, you know, it can be a really great tool for that. But of course, if you have an eating disorder and then now you're hungry, that's terrifying. Like, that's really hard to deal with, or it can be. So it definitely can be, I guess the word would be triggering for those with an eating disorder to kind of be using a substance that maybe stimulates the appetite like that. But also it potentially could be a form of controlled exposure, you know, to feeling hungry and engaging with food in a way that maybe your inhibitions are a little bit lowered. So I think it can be used as a tool in a lot of ways. And again, just like with stimulant medication, it's about providing a psychoeducation on what it would could and might look like, and continuing to sort of engage with your client on how they're feeling with the substance, and you know, what is it doing for them? What is it? What are the side effects? Like, do the pros outweigh the cons? And you know, it's just a sort of constant conversation and assessment as to how much it's helping or hurting. You know, and I think it's that's the case for any and every thing that we deal with.
Yeah, when you were explaining that about the pros and cons and stuff, I was thinking, this is generally what we do with clients anyway, isn't it? About anything. So it
It's the
would just
same.
be.
It's totally the same. It's just that it's with a substance that, of course, it is illegal in certain places, but is also stigmatized, you know. So it's definitely, to me, about treating cannabis like any other medication.
Yeah, I really respect your perspective. I'm still very much in that I'm a good girl, like I will
I
not be
get
sadistic
that.
to clients.
I get
But
that. I
obviously, if
do.
clients are using certain substances, I would talk through it in the way that you've been doing, and then it's ultimately their choice what they decide to do. So, what would you say to someone who came to you and said, "I just want to eat normally"?
I'd ask them what they think that means and what they think that looks like. Because I want to know, when you say eat normally, what does that mean to you? Because that on its face is going to give me a lot of information about the various narratives that you have in your own head about what is and isn't okay with food. It reveals food rules and rituals pretty well, I think. And I also would validate it, right? Because everyone wants to feel like neutral with food. Everyone wants that. Everyone wants to feel neutral about their body. People want to be able to move through their day and focus on what they need to focus on, the things that are very much outside of their control, like work responsibilities and all of that, and not have to worry about what they're putting in their mouth every 3 to 4 hours and how they look in their clothing. You know, it's just it's an annoyance in many ways. It's a nuisance to have to be constantly aware of those things. And so I think it's such a normal, natural desire, especially if you feel like your relationship with food is volatile. You know, I remember, like I said, when I first went to therapy, I was exhausted. You know, that was the thing that pushed me. I was just so tired of the it really, it felt violent, the cycling between binging and restricting. Like it was so draining. And so yeah, I think it I would ask questions. I would want to know what that means to them, and I would also validate it, because it's a natural thing to like want to not have to be distressed.
Yeah, thank you so much. And where could people find you?
Yeah, so my biggest platform, I guess, is Instagram. And my username there is Bad Ash Therapy. And then I have a website as well, ashmsaruya.com. And that'll actually redirect you to ashleymsaruya.com, because I'm still in the process of changing all of that. Yeah, you can find all of my art on my website for sale. I do digital downloads, and I actually am coming out with a new drop on October 2nd at 12 p.m. All the stuff is coming off of the website on September 15th. I don't know when this is coming out, but and new stuff is getting added on October 2nd.
Okay, well, considering it's the 14th today, it will not be done by tomorrow. But you're actually quite lucky because sometimes I batch them and then they don't come out for ages because I'm really unorganized.
Awesome.
But actually, I don't have any in the lineup, so hopefully it will be coming out soon. Based on when we record, I will definitely do it before. Did you say the 2nd of
October
October?
2nd.
Yeah, okay, I'll definitely do it before then.
Amazing. I appreciate that. But
Okay.
yeah, so there will be new art available on the site on October 2nd.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, for
Yeah.
being a guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Just Eat Normally podcast. I hope you found this enjoyable, interesting, and insightful and informative. And if you did, make sure to subscribe to hear the next episode. And just remember that you can check out the show notes for contact details and extra resources.